This is the Culture and Conversations Podcast, and I am your host, Jameson Smallwood. Glad to be back doing another episode, bringing you my content, my thoughts, my ideas. Remember, this is my Facebook, social media, Instagram, all that stuff, stewed down into audible format so that you can listen. And as well, if we're blessed, we'll have a great conversation to also take part in the episode. I had my good friend Christopher Pugh stop by. He's an aspiring comedian, and we got a chance to chat a good bit. Also, as we talk about what's going on in the culture, apparently we've got more fake outrage. People are mad that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was used to sell trucks. So we're going to talk about that. Also, Jemele Hill, she used to be a Sports Center anchor. Got to talk about what that means when she stepped down. She stepped down from her job as a Sports Center anchor to return to more of a role as a journalist. We're going to chat about these things. I'm so glad to be able to do this one more time. Culture and Conversations. Let's get it. This is the Culture and Conversations Podcast, and I am your host, Jameson Smallwood. Glad to be able to sit down and chat a bit about some of the things going on in the culture, and also talk about some of the things that I've come across in the life of my friends that I want to share with you guys, and the conversations that we have, and some of the things that are enlightening that come from their experience as they pursue their dreams and their goals and their aspirations. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was Dr. King and this controversy that has erupted because Dodge, the car company, used Dr. King's speech that he gave, about being a servant leader, to sell trucks. And I get the idea of what the ad was trying to communicate. So we're going to play that and just give you the opportunity to hear it just so you can have some context for what it is we're talking about before we really launch off into the discussion. But I wanted to talk about this from the standpoint of a fake outrage, because I believe it's a great example, yet again, of fake outrage.
If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. By giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great. You don't have to know about Plato and Aristotle to serve. You don't have to know the theory of relativity to serve. You don't have to know the second theory of thermodynamics in physics to serve. You only need a heart full of grace. Soul generated by love.
That was a great speech, a great sermon from Dr. King. And I love it because as a Christian, I believe obviously in the idea of being a servant leader. And for those who don't know what that is, the idea of being a servant leader came from how Jesus dealt with his disciples who were having a dispute about who would be, in charge or be, the exalted in the new reality of the kingdom of God that Jesus was ushering in. And Jesus quickly dealt with them by teaching them that. If you look at my example, talking about the example of Christ, hey, you see me serving, you see me waiting on you guys here, feeding you at this dinner table, and yet I'm greater than all of you. So if you want to truly be great, then you need to serve. And this idea is awesome in terms of what they're trying to communicate in the ad, because the advertisement's whole concept or premise is that, instead of them just telling you how great their truck is, and why you should buy their truck and why it's better than the competition, it appeals to this idea that the truck is going to serve you in your, you know, daily walk of life, whether it's just being a regular commuter or being someone who, you know, is involved in heavy duty work, which is what a truck is ultimately, you know, in part designed to do. So this is what the advertisement is trying to communicate, that the truck is going to be your servant, and that because it's such a great servant in its function and role in your life as the vehicle that you purchase, that it's going to, you know, it's going to stand out head and shoulders above the competition as being the greatest. And Dr. King's sermon articulated the idea from a theological standpoint, and they bring this into the advertisement. Well, apparently people who had issue with Dodge using Dr. King's speech, you know, they came and began to display, you know, outrage. And I call it fake outrage because I don't think they were really that offended to begin with. I think they just don't like, to some degree, capitalism and the idea of people actually selling stuff and making money. But this isn't a political podcast, so we're not going to go too deep into that. But this is what the counterpoint was given as being for why this commercial shouldn't have been made to begin with, because they had another speech from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and they said that this is what he actually thought about, you know, car advertisements. So let's listen to that, and then I'm going to give you a critique of that, and we'll move on from this topic and just, you know, this topic of fake outrage.
The presence of this instinct explains why we are so often taken by advertisers. You know, those gentlemen of massive verbal persuasion, and they have a way of saying things to you that kind of gets you in the bind. In order to be a man of distinction, you must drink this whiskey. In order to make your neighbors envious, you must drive this type of car. In order to be lovely to love, you must wear this kind of lipstick or this kind of perfume. And you know, before you know it, you're just buying that stuff. And I've got to drive this car because it's something about this car that makes my car a little better than my neighbor's car. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America.
And yet again, another great speech from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The key piece that we have to look at as we deal with this information being out here, you know, battled around in the culture, is that the beginning of that speech sets the context for what Dr. King actually meant. And I'm talking about this last speech. I'm going to play that first part again because I want us to really hear what he said. He said he mentioned something about an instinct, and that's what we have to understand. And I'm going to find the full context of it for you so that we can have it.
The presence of this instinct explains why.
He said the presence of this instinct. So let's see what we can find here. So I've pulled up the actual speech that is used as a rebuttal of the Super Bowl advertisement by the Dodge Ram brand. And you can see in the speech that he's not talking about the idea of advertisement being evil. What he's talking about in the speech is this instinct that he calls the drum major instinct, that is actually the tendency of people from just looking at the context clues of the speech to rally around certain ideas, to rally around the influence of certain ideas. And he's criticizing the instinct, not the actual things that play to the instinct. And I think that's where we have to look at what he said. In its proper context, because the same thing that Dodge was accused of doing, taking this speech out of context and using it to sell cars, now you've got the anti-capitalists who are taking his speech, another speech of his, out of context and using it to rebut this other speech that they claim was taken out of context. So I want to just bring that up because this is how these things work in the world that we live in, where, you know, people are constantly presenting us with information, they're constantly presenting us with ideas. And even tonight, you know, on my podcast, I present you with a perspective that's coming from information that I'm giving you. But I'm trying to give you sources of information. If you want to look at this actual speech that they claim was bashing advertisement and car advertisement, you can look at it at the kingencyclopedia.stanford.edu. And that's going to be /encyclopedia/documents/entry/doc_the_drum_major_instinct. And he's talking in the speech about this rallying, this tendency to rally around someone who's leading a charge, you know, like a drum major. So that's what he's talking about. And he's not saying the advertisement's evil. But if anything, he's saying that our response as people to advertisement is evil, and it is worthy of critique, I should say. I don't necessarily call it evil, but just definitely is worthy of critique. And if I was in church, I'd call it evil, but on the podcast, I'm not going to call it evil. It's just worthy of critique. It's something that we need to be examined and take a look at. So we have this issue going on, a fake outrage that is erupting, and we should really just be conscious of what you know, of what people are doing, right? In some ways, it's hilarious because the very thing that they're using to critique the original Super Bowl ad by Dodge, the drum major instinct speech, is really the very instinct that they're using to drum up, if you will, support for this bad idea. And, you know, I think that's, you know, this bad critique of Dodge Ram. So, you know, I'm not a Dodge Ram enthusiast or you know, fanboy or anything like that. I drive a Chrysler, you know, 300, which is a part of the Dodge family, you know, is an extension of it under Chrysler, but I mean under GM. But at the end of the day, I don't care, right? I just want people to think. And that's what I'm trying to present as I talk about these things. So the next thing that's on my list of stuff to bring to you is recently Jemele Hill, who is a former SportsCenter anchor, has resigned, and she's actually gone back to a job of being a columnist for ESPN. And, you know, Jemele, it was an interesting story because Jemele has done a couple of different things while she's been at ESPN in the position of a SportsCenter anchor that has, you know, brought her under fire and under criticism. You know, she's made comments about, you know, the protests in the NFL, the player protests around the flag and police brutality. And I don't necessarily want to get into what, you know, is right and wrong with the protests, because, you know, I believe that we have the right of freedom of expression to tell, you know, to tell our particular viewpoint from a political standpoint if we, you know, if we want to. And we can share that with whoever we want to share it with, whoever will indulge us and listen to us. However, the problem with Jemele Hill is the same problem that you see with Colin Kaepernick and that you see with a lot of athletes and people who don't own the stage and platform that they're actually on. And that is that when you exercise that right, you're not truly free of consequence when you don't own the platform that you're using to bring this position out to the world. You know, so here she is, you know, using her fame and her following that she's gained as being a part of ESPN's larger, you know, media platform, known as SportsCenter and ESPN, all these platforms that they've built. And she's using that fame as a face and representative of ESPN. And she's, you know, making these statements that, you know, are great and great sentiments if that's what you hold to. But it is seen as being bad for business for ESPN. So she has been, you know, suspended and she's been reprimanded a couple of times because of these comments. And at the end of the day, she just doesn't own the platform that she's trying to speak from and use to criticize, the culture. She doesn't own the platform. And I think that's something that's so key for us to think about in any walk of life, is that if you're gonna be critical and you want to bring about change, you've got to be in position to own your platform to do so. You know, the Culture and Conversations podcast, that's my podcast. You know, that's my podcast. This is my content. Whoever listens to it is choosing to listen to it. Through the channels that I'm providing it through, such as iTunes, such as, you know, Facebook posts, such as a link directly to the podcast site. nobody can stop me from doing that. Even if these platforms that I'm using decided to stop, you know, allowing me to publish my content, the internet, for now, is open and free, and I can take it and go and publish it someplace else. And no one can come to me and say, hey, your idea that you said in podcast episode number 6 is so reprehensible that we're not going to allow you to post it, because I can just post it anywhere I want to as long as I have, you know, access to the openness of the internet, because I own this platform. You know, I may not own the channels that I'm submitting the content through, but the following that this podcast has generated and the people who are following me, they can access it anytime they want to. I mean, I can email it to people if I wanted to distribute it that bad. So you have to be able to own your platform if you're going to have opinions, if you're going to have rhetoric, things that you're going to bring to the table in terms of your strong views. And Jemele Hill, you know, I love her job that she did at ESPN as an anchor. I love her and her partner, Michael Hill, who, they brought this sort of representation to the platform of minorities. But at the end of the day, you have to own your platform. And just because ESPN gave her this opportunity, to share her position, to share her voice, that doesn't mean that, you know, they gave her ownership. And I called him Michael Hills. Actually, Michael Smith. That's what I was trying to think of. I confused his last name with Jemele Hills. But Michael Smith and Jemele Hill, you know, they represented an image of being younger, trendier, you know, urban, if you will. And ESPN was trying to leverage that, obviously, for for ratings in the evening. But here you go with a classic example of not owning your own platform. So she couldn't hold to these opinions that she had, even though she wasn't using the platform directly. She was just using her Twitter feed or, you know, her following on social media. She still had that fame intertwined in such a way where ESPN said, nope, we're not going to allow you to, you know, to go around saying these things and hurting our ability to gain sponsorship and participation from, you know, larger brands such as the NFL. So we've got to understand that ownership is a key piece of what we do in an economy. That gives us power, that gives us leverage. Without ownership, we're just basically labor. We're help. And, you know, at any point in time, the people who actually own the opportunity that we're accessing the economy through, such as a job, can come along and say, nope, we don't want you anymore because you don't own anything. You don't own this opportunity to access the economy. You know, we own it, and we're just giving you a chance to participate as labor. So, best of luck to Jemele Hill as she continues to fight the good fight to advance her particular viewpoint of social causes. But this is just another cautionary tale or another wake-up call to us as citizens to understand that we have to have leverage. And in a capitalistic society, leverage comes through ownership. So, speaking of leverage, the last bit of my cultural critique, I guess, I have to share with you guys is that, you know, Valentine's Day is just around the corner. And Valentine's Day is an interesting time because people often post really, you know, really thoughtful, funny, hilarious, sad, bitter, jaded comments on Facebook about dating and that sort of hopeless romantic stuff. And, you know, it gets really interesting because people, they want you to know that they're celebrating Valentine's Day, but they may not be happy with the person they're out with, or they may not want to claim the person that they're out with. So, you know, the pictures are kind of hilarious. Like if you really want to know where you stand at on Valentine's Day, then, you know, if you don't show up in the picture on social media together, if you're the guy holding the camera while she's striking all these poses at the restaurant that you paid out your pocket to take her to, or she's taking pictures of the stuff you sent her, but she doesn't tag you in the pictures. If he posts where he's at and he doesn't tag you in the post, letting the world know that he's there at this thing with you, then you might not be that much of a Valentine after February 14th. You know, it's funny how relationships and love and all these social dynamics play out on social media, because we want people to see the best of ourselves, but we want to, you know, obviously, you know, curate that information and sort of hide certain bits and pieces of it. And it's really funny how the peer pressure to be in a relationship, to get that quote unquote Valentine's Day card from someone, or that attention on Valentine's Day, plays out. And, you know, I know, as one who has been home on Valentine's Day and not actually doing anything other than sitting at home looking at TV. And if it was one of those Valentine's Day where I was really in my feelings, would not be a guy with somebody, maybe I was sitting down drinking an adult beverage. You know, I know the feeling of being, you know, caught up in that whole peer pressure. But I also know the victory I've had over that over the years, where I'm just like, I just could care less, you know, what, you know, people think about my plans and what I did and didn't do. Because at the end of the day, I'd rather be with someone who's not superficial, or not into me for a superficial reason, such as, oh, I'm going to be sweet to them on Valentine's Day. I want to actually have a meaningful relationship that if I choose to commemorate on Valentine's Day, then that truly means something. And it's not just some fake social construct that we came up with to promote, you know, our capitalistic agenda, as you know, like Hallmark holidays and stuff like that. So, you know, I want to just, you know, I want to always keep that in mind, or keep people encouraged with that, is that you don't have to let Valentine's Day be some bitter time of the year for you. It can really be a time where you just either are completely oblivious to it, or you can, you know, go and celebrate it with somebody that you know, you want to actually be sweet on. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, but either way, you know, just own your own happiness on that. You know, my like for you, my like of a post that I give you on Facebook, or my comment on IG that you, on a picture you post, that won't mean anything. Ultimately, what means something is the person that you're spending time with, do you care about them? And I mean, even if that's just you, are you spending time with yourself, and do you care about yourself? And, you know, we have to just keep these things in mind, because we are pressured. And that's the one thing I will agree with Dr. King's, or at least that's one application I should say I will take from Dr. King's, you know, sermon, the drum major instinct, is that we have to bring all that full circle, is that we have to make sure that we're marching to the right beat. And that beat that we march to, it can't be peer pressure. It can't be, you know, some type of lack of inner validation that we're seeking to fulfill through external means. It has to be simply, you know, do we love ourselves? And does that love enable us to love someone else and show that affection and that kindness and that sweetness, whether it's on Valentine's Day or whether it's on a completely different day of the year, of the calendar, you know? And so this Valentine's Day, you know, I'm going to just sit back and enjoy myself with the person that I'm going to enjoy myself with, whoever that is. And, you know, and if those plans change between now and then, cool, they change. But I'm not going to sit back and, you know, be defeated or caught up in the whole hype of the peer pressure part, or the stigma part of being by myself or being out with someone. I just want to have a good time and, you know, be sweet to someone, if that's not such a, you know, not such a, you know, shame. And I'm the type of guy who, you know, I'm an old school romantic. I like being sweet to people that I care about. And, you know, it may not go into this deep romantic relationship. It may not turn into the thing that launches me into this great lasting marriage. But at the end of the day, I did what I felt was, you know, something I wanted to do. I took ownership of my feelings and I expressed them towards someone, and you know, it's up to them to decide what they want to do with that. And I can't, you know, I can't fault them for doing what they want to. But at the end of the day, it doesn't change what Valentine's Day means. It doesn't make Valentine's Day mean more. It doesn't make it mean less. To me, it's just a day that I get a chance to, you know, have a little bit of fun and play around with this holiday and enjoy, you know, enjoy the fun that brings with it. And I think that's what we should always focus in on. I remember, I'll tell you this funny story, that I think it may have been third grade. I don't think it was third grade, but I think it was maybe it was second grade. Maybe, no, it wasn't that. It was fifth grade. And I never forget that I had a classmate who I was mortal enemies with. And if she's listening to this podcast, she's going to giggle when she hears it because we're still good friends. And what happened was that, you know, during Valentine's Day, you it's kind of a participation kind of thing where everybody has to give somebody a Valentine. And, you know, which I don't get that at all. I don't know why we teach kids that everybody's supposed to get a Valentine's Day. You know, maybe I don't want to give somebody else a Valentine's, you know, I'm kind of cynical that way. Like, maybe I don't want to give her a Valentine's Day card. Well, my friend, you know, she, me and her had, you know, we're enemies, quote unquote, back in the day. So, you know, I said, this is going to be interesting to see how she's going to handle giving me a Valentine's Day card. Because I said, I know if anybody's going to do this and do something evil, it's going to be her. Because I, at the time, I thought she was the most evil person in the world. And, you know, but we became friends, right? So some might call us frenemies. If there's a hint there about what, who I'm talking about and what I'm talking about. And, so she gives me this card and it has this just crazy, you know, message on the back of it. Cause at first it looked like just a regular Valentine's Day card, but then you roll it over on the back and she wrote some like evil message. Like, I'm only giving you this because I had to give you this. I still hate you, you know? And in hindsight, it was such a funny thing for somebody to actually write that, especially back then. It was like the most cruel thing in the world, you know? And I think that some of my issues with women and dating and life in general have stemmed from that moment. But in hindsight, I've been able to process it and laugh about it, obviously, and not take it too serious because, you know, these are things that kids do. But, you know, Valentine's Day has always been an interesting time in my life, to say the least. So, all right. So, you know, we talked about the culture and we've talked about all these great things that I've observed this, you know, over this week or whatever in preparation for the podcast. So finally, we get to the part of the podcast that I'm really, really happy with this week. I had a chance to talk to my good friend, Christopher Pugh, a.k.a. Big Chris. And we have sat down and talked, and we got into this great conversation about comedy and his life and what it means for him to be an aspiring comedian, sort of how he got into comedy, and also just how he made peace with living in his own skin as a big guy who got bullied and picked on in school. And how comedy became a tool that he used to humanize himself and to present himself to the people around him in a less threatening way because of their own insecurities, not his own, you know, but because of their own insecurities. And Chris is just a great friend. I'm rooting for him in his comedy career. I also found out that he does motivational speaking and that he's got a couple of different mentoring outlets that he uses to reach out to kids and bring them into a better understanding of who they are and what their potential in life is. And I just can't wait for you guys to hear this interview. So I was able to run down my friend, Christopher Pugh, and I wanted to reach out to Chris because Chris is an aspiring comedian. And Chris took some time to get on the phone with me and chat for a bit. Chris, what's going on, man?
Man, I'm chilling, James. How you doing, brother?
Man, I'm good, man. I'm good. Just out here dodging these women, sending me these messages about, you know, keeping their feet cold, you know what I'm saying, or keeping their feet warm.
Hey, man. You'd be surprised, man. A lot of women are anemic, man, is that all that, you know, that milk they've been drinking. Like, they always want a hug, you know what I'm saying, and they got really cold toes. So, you know, if you get frostbite on your calf muscles messing with you women out here, man, you got to stay woke.
Exactly, man. Exactly. We
straight up.
You know, just for the listeners, man, Chris is a big guy, too. So I'm a big guy, and Chris is a big guy. So, you know, every now and then we have a chance to kind of, you know, your crack jokes about, you know, being big guys. And Chris is, you know, Chris had me dying laughing on Facebook talking about, you know, unsolicited messages from these women who want to keep their feet warm during the winter by reaching out to big guys. So.
Bruh, they don't have any shame. They will lie to your face. They were just, women just lie. I mean, I had a woman to tell me the other day, I look just like T.I. I was like, ma'am, that's like skin tone, like transitioning. What? Let's try harder. Like, you know what I'm saying? I deserve better lives than that.
You, like,
You know, for real. It's like throw out Ice Cube or something. You know, somebody that makes sense.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? But you just showed me a guy that, you know, I don't even have that talent. At least I can act, but I can't rap.
Oh,
you
wow.
know, they just going for the gusto now, bro. It's like desperation. It's like you only got one book left, but you bid at eight.
Nice.
So,
yeah, you out here being light skinned man, using big words and
I know.
You know.
like he the king of the South, man. I'm the king of the, you know, restaurant. I mean, it's something different. Totally different, man. Totally different.
Cool, man. Cool. Man, the reason I started this podcast is because I wanted to talk to people like you who are doing, you know, what I find to be interesting stuff. And everybody, you know, who is doing something in the world, I don't care if you're a rocket scientist or I don't care if you're, you know, the president, you know, and we're not talking about the current president. We're talking about just the president in general, right? The office of the president.
Right.
You know, to me, like, I don't care what you're doing. You had to have the idea at some point in your mind to come up and say, hey, you know what, I want to do that particular thing. And when I got to thinking about all the people in my timeline on Facebook, all my friends and stuff I knew from college, it's like, man, you guys are doing amazing stuff. And you are in the process and you're on the journey of growing your comedy career. So the first question I wanted to ask you, man, is at what point, Chris, did you decide that, hey, I'm going to do comedy. I'm going to invest in doing comedy. At what point did that kind of hit you in your life? Were you young? Were you older? Were you in college? When did that thought cross your mind?
That thought crossed my mind when people started coming to ask me what I thought about a specific subject,
mm-hmm.
and people would pause to see what I would say.
Oh.
Yeah, it got a little weird, because I'm going to tell you how it started. And most comedians, you know, I'm pretty sure you've seen this before. A lot of comedians come out of tragedy, right?
Okay,
And, you know, in the same story here, you're going to hear it now.
Okay.
And, it's not too horrible, but, it you know, most comedy comes from pain, because you're trying to find something that's, you know, funny about something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in elementary school, you know, of course, I was a part of the heavyset community as well. then, my mom supported seconds, so you know it got when I was in elementary school, and a lot of people, you know, I'm pretty sure people know this. Elementary school children let you know what you look like on the planet. So
day one,
you know, yeah, man, and so you know, I didn't know that I was supposed to get critiqued. You know, I thought I came to learn. People were telling me what I look like. You know, and I got to the point, I was like, you know, the sadness started building up, because I was just looking around like, okay, I'm crying and I'm not even sad. Is this depression? What is this? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and the lady, she was like, why you keep moving your mouth? I like, because I keep tasting my tears. We get a grown up to come in here to stop some of this abuse, you know. I just want to learn a little math problem. That's all I want to do. But everybody over there to the corner, we're just having a good time. So I didn't know what was going on. Man, I was kind of confused. And then I think, man, one day I used to just take it, because I didn't know it was, you know, I didn't know if people were trying to, you know, be stupid or not. I'm from South DeKalb County, man. You take something too serious, man, the fight is coming next.
Exactly.
So I'm just sitting around. I'm like, man, I wonder when these jokes going to stop. And one day I found out they were never going to stop. Like, seriously. It got to the point where I was, yeah, man, it was the jokes. I'm walking to the bus stop. I hear the jokes through the bus window. That's when I was just like, I'm sitting up there. I'm like, man, I believe this may be terrorism. Because it got to the point, I went to the school, I like to file a complaint, but I don't know if there's a complaint against other children. What is this called, bullying? And then, you know, when you're a big child, you can't report bullying, because when your shoulder's wide, they just tell you to walk it off.
Your shoulder's wide, so they tell you to walk it off.
You see what I'm saying?
Well, you're right.
No, Fred, that's the test. That's a test. When you say, I've been bullying, they'd be like, let me see your shoulders. Boy, you ain't been bullying. You can take your big ass in there and shut up.
That's
you know what
it,
I'm saying?
Man.
So that's it. So, you know, it got to the point where I was like, all right, it looks like this stuff is not going to stop. And I done ran out of tears to the point I'm dehydrated.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, all right, so let's try something the next day. And I can't say it on the podcast. I'll show it with you when we get finished recording, because I know you're probably going to have, like, family members and children listening to this. But somebody said something to me one day, and, man, I just looked. I stood up, and I looked at the group, man, and but I pointed to one person. And I just said something to him that was so detrimental that I was calm with it, because you know how, you know, when you been holding something for too long and it spill out and you ruin the carpet, it's almost like I was a shaking up Coke bottle.
But Chris, you got to say it, man. You got to tell me what you said, because at worst, if I can't use it, I can always take it out. So you got to tell me what you said to this guy.
Well, this what I would do. It's equivalent to this. I can't tell you what I exactly said, because it was very terroristic. But literally, I told this guy, I said, I forgot his name, too. I remember what he looked like, though. And he was laughing and joking. I said, can I be honest with everybody here? Can y'all let me say one thing? And they were like, what? I said, everybody knows his mom is ugly. Like, she's huge. When she walks, animals stop doing what they're doing. I seen a squirrel drop a nut the other day when she got out the... And I just kept going, man, and it was going. And he was like, man, I'll fight you. And I said, and nothing will happen to your mother's face. She will look exactly the same. I said, you can whoop my ass and she'll still be your mom looking like the way she looks, buddy.
Oh, she does.
I don't know whether to hug her or ask her to run a route.
Wow.
I don't know.
You know
what I'm saying? So I would just... And, you know, and I cleaned it up, man, because I was saying some other stuff. You know, it got to the point. It was just horrible. It was just bad.
Wow.
And so, you know, yeah, man. And then, but his friends started laughing uncontrollably. And I said, and see, that's where I got to the point, because I was saving it. And I looked to him and I said, you see how your friends are agreeing with me? They're laughing. They're going to look like they're going to have your back. But when they get home, they're going to slap their knee saying, big boy was right. His mom is hideous.
Wow.
His mom is ugly. She, you know, she had that, you know, put like this. She had a face of a person that was supposed to have a Jerry curl but didn't. So what happened was well, every time you seen her, you looked at her like you were waiting for the Jerry curl to pop out, but it never did. So when you saw her, you were just consistently disappointed.
Oh, wow. Well, because you...
So you
Because you expected Jerry curl, like, she wasn't there.
Yeah, it was almost like when you saw her face, you tried to pull her scalp up to see if the Jerry curl was hiding up under her face. That's how she looked in the face. You know, that shiny person.
That shiny.
You know what I'm saying? That shiny but not quite attractive to humans.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was, you know, and I told him, I said, look, man, I've been holding this for a while, but, you know, and no matter what y'all can do, I think y'all probably are going to jump me after this. But I just wanted to get that out.
Wow.
And then that day, his friends came up. And you know, this is when I knew I was supposed to do this. I didn't know it then, but I know it by reminiscing about it like a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the day I became a comedian.
Wow.
When they came up to me, and I was just like, oh, are y'all here for the jumping? Is this his time for me to get the physical beat down now? Because your friend's feelings. And I used to talk like this because I ain't like yelling. Because when I get to yelling, like, I can't concentrate.
I've
always been a calm dude. So I said, okay, is it time for the beating? Are you guys here for the beating? And I said, I know you guys are not going to fight for it because I'm bigger than half of you. So which ones are going for the legs and which ones are going for the face?
Exactly.
I'd like to know. Yeah, I said, I'd like to know my adversary's moves before. You know, I used to talk like weird, man. And then they were just like, no. And then, you know, your nickname or your name in elementary is what you look like. So they were like, no, big boy, we just wanted to come tell you, man, that shit was funny as hell what you were saying on the bus, man. And I was just like, are you talking about, when I was talking about dad's, that guy's dad, mother, brother? They're like, what? I said, like his dad, his mother, and his brother emerged into one person.
His mother, brother. Dad, mother, brother.
His dad, mother, brother. And so they just loved it. I mean, they were just really having a good time. And then after a while, they just kept asking me what I thought about stuff and waited till I said stuff, and they just kept laughing. Fast forward after that, I mean, that happened like in third or fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it was at the Boys and Girls Club when people still kept trying to talk about me, and I just... What I would do, I used to get picked on so much, I'm too ready when somebody gets a joke on me. When I go into a room, I scan the room for everybody in the room and get at least two jokes on every human being in the room.
So,
I mean, that's how scarred I am.
But but see, that's what's funny to me is that me and you have a very similar story, you know. Like,
yeah.
You know, growing up, I was a big guy, and I got picked on just like that. And, you know, I wish I had developed more of a wit to dealing with it. And eventually I did develop it, but it didn't come as fast as yours came, where you were, you know, like in third, fourth grade, snapping on people.
You're a wit, because we was around pretty often, especially in undergrad. And I knew what you were going to do one day. See, what you would do, you were one of those guys that, yeah, people would have talked smack about you. You didn't say nothing, but you would purchase their apartment while they were asleep. Like, you would do that. Because you remember I used to tell you, I'm like, Jameson, you're going to make a lot of money one day, and we're going to keep in contact. You remember I used to tell you that?
You did tell me that. You did tell me that.
Yes, I like, man. And I like, Jameson, you always doing your homework on time, man. And that shit going to pay off, and I like to keep in contact with you. But I said, but Jameson, I would like to tell you that I can tell that you like absolutely around us. So as soon as one of these people slip, you're going to purchase their car while they at work. I like, I can do punchlines. You actually signed the dotted line. So your dotted line is worse than my punchline. Jesus Christ, man.
I didn't realize how much, you know, that crucible of social conflict that you described of, you know, being bullied and picked on at school. I didn't realize how much of that you really did shape, you know, my ability to be be funny, charming, witty, you know, sarcastic, you know. And I mean, those tools that you talked about, you develop, I recognize those in myself, you know, and recognize them in you, because, you know, that's just the experience of being a big guy and, you know, dealing with kids, because, you know, they bring out that in you, but you managed to turn it, obviously you managed to turn it into a path of comedy. So, you know,
right.
when you got to Southern, that I always knew you were a funny guy, you know, but you were real cool, you know what I mean? And at what point at Southern did you decide that, okay, I'm going to take this plunge and I'm going to step on stage with a microphone and these jokes and I'm going to try to make a whole bunch of people laugh? Did it happen before Southern, or did it happen at Southern?
Well, I was making people laugh for money. I wasn't on stage, but I created my stage, and I used to make people laugh for money.
Wow.
I went to Cedar Grove High School, man, and I had a band director named Mr. D. Mr. DeQuire, man, he was the coolest person on the planet. Actually, one of my mentors that helped me really channel my anger, because he could tell I was angry, but he would let me express myself. You know what I'm saying? Make it so bad, he let me stay in the band knowing that I didn't like being in the band. I just like being around positive people.
I got you. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
So, you know, he was a father to a lot of people. So what he used to let me do, I used to make people laugh for a dollar so I can get me an extra slice of pizza during lunch at Cedar Grove. So I was literally going around making folks laugh. And I had another classroom named Coach Edmondson at Cedar Grove. Anybody at Cedar Grove going to listen to this and remember.
Mm-hmm.
But in homeroom in the morning, I used to just make people laugh for a dollar.
Wow.
But I used to do some of the most unhuman, like, it wasn't comedy, man. It was more just uncomfortable chuckles. Like, it got to the point that everybody knew something was wrong, but wasn't nobody going to fix it because it was entertaining. You see how they go?
I know what you mean.
So I don't know if it was jokes. I think it was just like, all right, Chris, you'll make us uncomfortable right quick so we can just go on by our day.
Damn.
And I was like, sure, fellas. You know, let me throw my body against the door or something to make a huge sound to make the fire alarm go off.
Oh, wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was a little goofy stuff. I didn't have no jokes at the moment, but what I was doing was trying to make sure that I kept calm. What a lot of people don't know is when you get tried, it was a lot of fights, too. You know what I'm saying? Because I went to, you know, DeKalb County or whatever, and Chapel Hill and you know, Cedar Grove and stuff like that. It was a lot of people who couldn't wait for somebody to think they were bad. You know what I'm saying? So they could really show them that they wasn't. You know what I'm saying? And when you're a big dude, sometimes people want to try you just to see how, you know, they can beat up a big guy.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And, yeah, so with me, I found out that, and it was a couple of times that I literally lost my temper,
mm-hmm.
especially in middle school. And the time I lost my temper, I didn't even fight, but I got suspended.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I found out that adults, no matter, you know, who you are, when you're a bigger person and you're upset, it's a state of an emergency instead of a state of humanity.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true.
So when I found out now, I said, damn, I just got upset because I even got assaulted, and I got upset, and they were threatening to call the police on me for being upset. I was like, hold up. This is ass backwards.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yep. I say, hold on. Adults are scared? Y'all just sat there and let the people assault me.
Mm-hmm.
But y'all scared of what I'm finna do? I said, something's backwards. So what I found out that when I lose my temper, everybody loses their common sense.
Yep.
And so sometimes when people don't know what to do, they end up doing too much. So what I internalized was I didn't say that my feelings weren't valid. What I did know that the world is going to misunderstand my body language, because my body language, it doesn't matter how I'm sitting, it's just the fact that I'm there.
Exactly. Yep.
You see what I'm saying? So my shoulders say shit when my mouth is closed.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? The way I walk. I remember one time one dude said, man, you walk like you finna try to whoop somebody's ass. I said, man, I gotta pee. I said, man, I just had to use the bathroom. He's like, no, man, you just walk like you better than everybody. I said, bro, I'm bow-legged, man, and my bones are hurting.
And you tall. Yeah. You tall and big, man. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. My back is wide, man. And I ain't got no bicycle to ride, so my feet hurt. You know what I'm saying? But it was people always responding to how they felt about me instead of what I was saying.
Ah, I got
So I had two choices. I can go out there and get real aggressive,
mm-hmm.
and get angry and really show these people how bad they not how bad I think I am, but I'll show them how bad they wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I had a couple of people kind of threaten me to, you know, threaten to take my life. I had, you know, a couple of guns pulled on me here and there, and people showing their guns. And, you know what I'm saying? People, you know, threatening stuff. And I was just like, wow, and I sing in a quiet church. You don't want to die like this.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That's very confusing. You're like, dang, he sung so beautifully on Sunday. How many bullets was it?
Exactly.
So, you know, it's kind of confusing. So what I did was I said, all right, I'm going to have to make a choice. I'm either going to be real violent, or I'm going to be real funny, or I'm going to have to sell a lot of drugs to keep everybody.
And you...
So, you know, I couldn't even pass the drug orientation because I was so nervous. I was like, man, comedy it is.
That's it.
That was it. So I just chose comedy because it increased my humanity. It allowed people to take their guard down a little bit so they can actually person. Because right now, before the jokes come out, they see the threat.
I got you.
You know what I mean? So you know, that was just me trying to make sure that society didn't overreact to my stature when I came in the room. Because, I mean, to this day, people say, man, I thought you was an asshole. I said, I was out there giving candy to children. He was like, yeah, man, but you look like you were going to whoop somebody there doing it. I'm like, well, ain't nothing I can do. Ain't nothing I can do.
Nothing you can do, man. And,
ain't nothing I can do, bro.
Yeah. I've got another buddy, man. He's a big guy, too. And me and him were having this conversation about just how our presence just changes a room, you know. And,
right.
You know, I see it all the time. You know, when I go to work or, you know, I'm involved in around certain people and, you know, I have to do things to make them comfortable. And part of that is the humor and the wit and the, you know, the conversation, the banter, just whatever, to disarm that thing in them that makes them worried that, you know, oh, this dude's a gangster. Yeah. I'm like, I'm so far from a gangster. What gangster, you know, wear glasses and can program computers? Like, I'm not a threat to anybody other than, you know. I'm not threatening anybody other than like maybe a little Debbie sandwich or something, you know. Like
that's hilarious.
I'm not dangerous to anybody.
That's hilarious.
You know.
The only time I'm dangerous is around Thanksgiving, bro.
That's
like,
it, bro.
Everything's digging. Everything's digging.
That's it. I know you grew up with this in this space of trying to figure out how to be, like you said, more human to people who were at least perceived as more human, and comedy gave you an opportunity to do that. You know, at Southern, when was the first time you got on stage at Southern?
It was 2004 at the PSC Lounge. It was stood for poetry, singing, and comedy. And I would not do this interview without shouting these two people out who convinced me to get on stage.
Okay.
Now, what I used to do was it's one thing about getting on stage and doing comedy, but I used to do comedy all the time in the pool room.
Yep.
You remember that pool room that used to be in the Union where Starbucks is now at Florida Southern?
Yeah.
In the pool room and in the Union and stuff like, man, we used to just crack jokes nonstop. I mean, it was entertainment groups in there. I remember Steady Rising was in there. Yeah, Boys was in there.
Steady Rising.
All of the entertainment groups. Yeah. All of the good people who just wanted to make sure that people had a good time.
Yep.
I used to hang around all of them, man. And they used to, you know, invite me to their homes and stuff, and they had cookouts and stuff. So what I used to do is just be myself around a whole bunch of different people.
Mm-hmm.
And people would start digging it. So one day, I had a friend of mine. He's now my frat brother. His name is Rashad Middlebrooks, and another really good friend of mine. He was my upstairs neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
That's a guy named David Pierce.
Okay.
And both of them approached me and was like, man, I think we really need to do a comedy show. Like, we seeing what you're doing,
uh-huh.
and you're a certified idiot. We just want you to, you know, be on a space where people can actually hear you through a microphone.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, you know, I'm actually down. You know, let me know how I can roll with it. So they set it up. They had a connection or whatnot, rented out a club called Apex. Now,
Apex.
Old Georgia Southern, remember Apex Lounge,
yep.
right? It was right next to Legends a long time ago down in that patch of dirt. And if it was raining, your knees was going to be brown, right, when you get in the club.
That's
so
it.
I remember it was around Valentine's Day 2004, my first show ever. And my very first stand-up routine was 1 hour and 20 minutes.
Man, that's a lot of material, man. But, I mean, for you to have waited your whole life to do it, and you having,
right.
you had a set, you know what I mean? Like, that's... Really, that's like, man. Probably, depending on what you're talking about, if you're talking about 20-minute sets, that's like 6 20-minute sets. You know what I'm saying?
Man.
That's hilarious.
And I was just going off. And one of the things when I tell some of my mentees who are aspiring comedians as well, I said, sometimes comedy, like, I'm not going to lie to you, the vast majority of comedy is telling the truth.
Mm.
And the other percentage is being confident in your truth.
Yeah.
So you got to tell the truth, and then you got to be confident in your truth. So when I get on stage, it's one thing about trying to make people laugh, and it's a whole other thing is making sure people understand what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying? That's true. That's true.
And that's what I tell people who any try. You know, and I'm not the best comedian on the planet. I'm not. You know, I don't have all the experience on the planet. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But comedy with me. The career that I had was not a career that I was looking for.
Mm.
It was a career that developed because I was out there trying to function.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So a part of my functionality, and you know, you get up once and then people like you, they keep trying to book you and keep telling you about shows and talent shows and things of that nature. All of a sudden, it's just second nature.
Wow.
So after they did that, it was 1.5-hour special. Then we went to the after party. It's just right up the street, and people were just telling me how much of a good time they had, and you were natural and stuff like that. What they didn't know is all the times I was making people laugh in the classrooms, all the way from middle school, all the way up through high school, if you know, and all the way up and through my undergrad years until like my sophomore, junior year.
Mm-hmm.
And I had so much material, I just told what happened.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I also rode a bike at Georgia Southern, old school Georgia Southern. Remember this, because they used to call me Debo. And they had all the jokes in the world because couldn't nobody see my bike seat when I was riding. So it hurt then, but it's funny now though, because that's true though. Couldn't nobody see it.
That's funny.
You know, and I told them they weren't supposed to be looking for a bike seat. Just shoot your douches and you know, make sure I go to class. That's about it. But I would say that first 1.5-hour special, that's when I knew it was something for real.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I started winning talent shows, and I had to shout out Gamma Sigma Sigma Sorority.
Uh-huh.
They had a lot of different talent shows back in the day, and they would allow me to perform in them, and I used to win them.
Oh, wow.
I used to win a lot of them. And then the Sigmas used to have comedy shows. I remember they brought down Shouty, Redbone, and Nard Holston, and and different things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And I used to host the shows, and I used to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to shout out the Alphas at Georgia Southern. The Alphas at Georgia Southern saw me, and they used to book me to host their step shows.
Mm-hmm.
Not every year, but it was a vast majority of years, and that was an extra source of income for me. Mm-hmm. So I got to shout them out, much respect to them. And every time I just did it, I just tried to be myself and just said what I felt in a way that was kind of genuine, because when you're dealing with a black audience, they can tell when you're faking.
Yeah.
What I used to do is just be like, hey, man, I'm going to just tell y'all what happened. I'm going to tell y'all what I just saw and tell you how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And you can decide if you want to laugh or not, man. But I had so much support, James, and it ain't even funny.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing about being funny. But when you have support, you just got to maximize your support and just make sure you support your support. And that's what I tried to do. Because even if I wasn't trying to be the best comedian, the people that wanted me to be great, I needed to be great out of respect for them wanting me to be great.
Wow. Yeah, that's true.
You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
So it ended up being I started hosting Pretty Nasty Step Shows. Mm-hmm. I used to host Blackshin for BSA. Man, I hosted a whole bunch of different random stuff, man. And it was just because people, you know, they really dug how I spoke and what I was talking about and the genuineness of the material.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even that vulgar, man. You know, sometimes I cuss a little bit, man, but I was just telling you some of the stuff I just saw, man. It was just so funny. The only thing I had to do was just tell it. And, you know, right now I'm still developing and seeing where it goes.
Yeah. Now before we move on from you mentioning those fraternities and sororities, what's your frat, man, so that you can give your organization some shine?
I'm the Bruhs from Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated. Zeta Zeta Chapter, Zeta Delta Delta, Giant Head, Georgia Southern, man, 405.
All right, man. I just want to make sure you got that plug in, brother.
The Bruhs, like, seriously, and this is the funny thing, right before I decided to pledge, a lot of Bruhs were my friends who actually supported the movement of my comedy a lot. Just like I said before, Rashad Middlebrooks, he's one of my pro fights.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Q when he decided to do, well, no, he wasn't a Q yet. He was about to be a Q right when he helped me do that first comedy show.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already a lot of people that I already knew. And then when I became a Q, I was just hosting all of our pageant, talent shows, any step show that we had, I was hosting all of it. So I owe a lot to the Bruhs, man. The Bruhs definitely looked out. Now they're constantly asking me to host stuff now.
And see, what I would love for people to take away from this is that, you know, in your becoming a comedian, you didn't just wake up one day and say, hey, I want to be a comedian. You really embraced the opportunities that were around you, whether it was, okay, I'm in a classroom full of these knucklehead kids who are talking trash about me, or you got to the point where it was like, okay, I'm in the pool room, and I'm going to make these guys in this pool room and pool hall laugh. And then it got to from there. It was like, okay, now I'm on stage at this comedy show because my friends believe in me and they're going to give me an opportunity to do this. I mean, I never forget when you had a chance to host that comedy show with you mentioned Redbone and I think it was Michael Blackson.
Michael Blackson. Yeah. I remember that show. I definitely do.
And, like, there's a moment, I think there's a moment in everybody who's aspiring to do something. I know I had the same moment when I was programming computers, you know, professionally. I mean, I remember the same, I had the same moment. You're with people who do this do this for a living, who got talent at it. They paying bills. They eating off of what they do. And now you're the guy who's trying to become that. You were in the moment, and you didn't just hold your own. It was clear that, okay, you're going to do this. You know what I mean? Like you really showed up and did it. I told, I was telling Shiara Richardson the same thing. I spoke to her on my last episode. And when she did.
I remember Shiara. Shiara helped me. She was in Gamma Sigma Sigma, I believe.
Okay.
And she helped me get down with some of the talent shows and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So you said, I was telling her the same thing I just told you. I mean, it's just when she did her, she did the episode of Versus the Flow that I saw her on. You know, it just was clear, like, okay, she's clearly arrived. And you know, for you to be up there in college, man, with all of these seasoned, you know, touring comedians who are names that you know, real bona fide comedy stars. And you were like, you know, you were in the moment and you were doing your thing and it wasn't out of place. I was like, man, you know, he's going to really, you know, take it to that next level, man. And, you know, I every time I see something you know, that you post, man, or hear about you doing something, I'm like, yeah, man, I wish I could either go support it or I definitely got to check it out when it comes up on the internet because it's dope, man. It's always dope. It makes me laugh all the time.
Man, I appreciate you saying that, bro. Straight up. I think I'm my career, man, I'm really thankful because people don't have to support you. I've noticed a lot of people who are talented, they just don't have the support.
Yeah.
When I really just saw that, man, I just got more humble in my approach to it. Now I'm hungry though. You know what I'm saying? I'm not so humble to the point I don't think I'm good at what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I've literally seen people who I'm talking about masterminds at their craft, but they just don't have the support. And I was just like, man, it got to the point where I just got too much support to quit it.
Because
I wasn't even trying to be a comedian. Like I said before, I was just trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But I had so much support, and I was like, you know, I'm going to try for y'all.
Nice.
You know, I'm going to just keep trying for y'all, man. You know, it's not – and it wasn't even a debt. It was more of a respect. Like,
yeah.
I respect y'all enough to, you know, when you came around me and tried to really invest in me, I'm going to respect your investment.
Yeah.
I'm going to go try.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's where I'm at.
That's huge, man. I've got some other things, man, along this line of just talking about comedy in general to run mm-hmm. by you and just get your thoughts on, one of the things that I'm seeing a lot of on the internet is I've got a term I'm trying to coin called crowdsource comedy.
Crowdsource, okay.
Yeah, and... Okay. And we all are familiar with it. It's just I'm trying to put a buzzword to it so that, you know, it can sound legit when I go around saying it. But basically, right. You know what I'm saying? All the memes, these funny pictures with these captions.
It's hilarious.
You know, just everything that comes out of the internet, right? Because, for instance, if you, like the people who make a meme that goes viral, you don't know that person in there who wrote that meme, you know. But it's sort of anonymous, you know, and it's just out there, and they shared it, and then it got shared and shared and shared and went viral. You don't know any of these people, mm-hmm. but the internet or the collective of people on the internet, the crowd on the internet, they're the ones who gave us, you see what I'm saying, that joke that we laughed at when we looked at our phone, you know.
Right.
And I want to get your thoughts about that. As comedy has gone through, you know, always goes through evolutions. You know, you can go back as far as Chaplin and what he did, all the way to, like, you know, your contemporary people like a Dave Chappelle, you know, and maybe a little bit further back and a little bit further from Chappelle, like, you know, Eddie Murphy or, you know, or Richard Pryor. But as the internet grows, how do you see comedy leveraging the internet and all this technology and these different platforms, social media, like I said, this whole idea of crowdsource comedy, how do you see all that coming mm-hmm. together to take comedy into the next generation?
I think it has sparked the entrepreneurial
Ooh.
Aspect of comedy.
Very good. Okay.
I think it's going to really aid in the ability for comedians to feed themselves without the politics of someone allowing you on their stage.
Ooh.
And let me kind of elaborate on that.
Okay.
I mean, that's the reason why I respect, you know, the OGs of comedy, like Corey Holcomb, Patrice O'Neill, mm-hmm. you know, Kevin Hart. I mean, you know, Richard Pryor and everybody, the greats, man, like, you know, Eddie Murphy and all of those. When we call the stage, you know, a lot of comedians that I work with, we call the stage the workout room.
Okay.
Well, if somebody's working on that, you ever go to a crowded gym?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you've been waiting on that one machine all day. You just, it's leg day, but everybody got leg day that day, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you just sitting there like, you know, this is my time. I'm supposed to have leg day, but for some strange reason, you know, they're like, look, man, this is the only equipment we got. You know, just try your luck next time, right? But for a lot of comedians, when they try to get on stage, there is a political aspect of comedy that a lot of people don't talk about. You know what I mean? And, you know, a lot of people you can take it personal or you can just take it serious. I took it serious because if you don't own your stage, you can't guarantee you're really going to get up on it.
That's true. That's true.
So what happens is social media gave every comedian his and her own stage that they don't have to sign up to allow somebody for them to be on. So it made it made people business owners of their own comedy, and you can record your own jokes with your face now, and it can be dated. So when somebody does your material, you can prove that you did their material first.
If
that even makes any sense for anybody. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I really think, see, with me, I have to respect, like, ain't nothing like the weight room. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like, social media is almost like popping a DVD in your living room.
I got you.
Yeah, you can get a workout in, but it's nothing like going to the gym with all those other amenities that's going to help you get holistically better. You know what I'm saying? You got all these different equipments, and that stage, for some strange reason, it brings a whole element spiritually out of a comedian.
I know what you mean.
The eye contact with the audience. I mean, honestly, on a raised level, when you have a microphone and you're the most important voice in the room, there is something spiritual about that I can't really put my finger on.
It's
a high.
It's almost like a pulpit, man. And
it is. It's church.
You know,
it's church.
And really, the best comedians I've observed, you know, as we talk about the stage, and, you know, some of the best comedians I've observed, they actually help inform me when I'm teaching and preaching, you know, on occasion, because I don't want people thinking I'm a preacher, right? But on occasion, when I have a chance to go and speak at my church or in my church community, I borrow tons of material. I don't want to say material, but I borrow tons of concepts of delivery, stage presence, just how to work the room from watching comedy, man. I really do.
Right, right. And also, too, let me say this before I forget, because I don't need to forget this. One of the main reasons why I chose comedy is two main reasons. First of all, my family is hilarious. My family is hilarious. My brother that I grew up with in the same house, hilarious. It was something funny all the time. He can make you literally, you make your body produce urine prematurely. He's that funny, right? And I grew up with seven uncles on my mom's side, and I'm talking about the comedy is nonstop. My Uncle Richard is the funniest person I've ever met in my life, right? And he's calm, and I've never seen him upset, and that's the reason why I start hanging around him so I can get his temperament. I've never seen him pissed off. Now, and he's one of those people that you never want to see pissed off because he's that nice. That means when he get mad, somebody got to leave the planet.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? And on top of that, you know, I got several cousins. We were all just having fun and whatnot. My best friend, David, and my best friend, my brother, Brian, you want to see the grow with me. We used to sit down and we used to crack jokes nonstop. During my college years, I have to say this before we keep going. The none other than the great Barbara Carlisle, and I need to make sure I shout her out. Barbara Carlisle actually spotted me on one of these shows she was actually hosting at Georgia Southern. And this is one of the shows that I came out there with a Baby Ruth in a sandwich bag as a necklace. And because I went out there and I said, well, you know, she's like, what the hell is that on your neck? I said, it's my medicine. If I don't take it every once in a while, I start flipping out and biting people. And she was like, now that's hilarious. And she like, that's stupid, but it's funny. And so at that moment, we exchanged information, and I started doing comedy shows with her all the time. She started taking me on the road. She started coaching me. She used to work with me with my delivery. I can call her up right now and run some jokes by her, and she will give me a better punchline or a different concept to think about or encourage me on my writing. And another thing, Everett Robinson, I got to shout out Eazy-E down here at the pool hall. Do you remember me seeing me on Facebook and saying we ain't down here at Main Street Billiards? It's Main Street Billiards down here at Statesboro, Georgia. Right?
I remember Main Street Billiards, yeah.
Main Street Billiards, right. When I first met E, he saw me do comedy, and he was like, look, man, I've seen you before. I believe in you. I think you're funny. Anything you need, I got you. You know, so I'll support you. He started booking shows for me, and that man allowed me to do my own shows in his pool hall.
Wow.
To get not only my skills up, but he allowed it to for me to highlight talent in Statesboro.
Oh, wow.
And he used to, yes, man. So, like I keep saying before, like, and that's the reason why, you know, this is not my only interview, but I don't want to have an interview when I forget people.
I got you.
You know what I'm saying? Because I would be remiss to say I got this far, which, you know, it ain't made it yet or whatever, but I've gotten far specifically based off support.
Wow.
Wow. it was just nonstop support. So I wanted to get that out there before I keep going on about the comedy, because I will forget that. I really will, but I don't want to forget that. But like I was saying before, as far as the entrepreneur aspect, when comedians are actually controlling their own voice, and you don't have to wait till somebody has a show, and you don't have to wait till somebody feels like putting you on, and you don't have to feel like, hopefully I did the right thing. You just put it out there and let the people tell you if you're funny, and you got your own audience. You know what I mean? So I think it's pretty positive. I really do. I think people's intentions are shown behind what they do, and you can see them out in the open in front of everybody. But I think it's pretty positive. I really do.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You know, about that, you said a key piece there I wanted to touch back on and briefly is that, you know, you're talking about owning your own stage and then not having to deal with the politics of getting put on that stage. You know, we're seeing that play out. We're seeing that play out in this situation that's been in the news the last week about Monique and Netflix, you know.
And
I mean, you just nailed it. You really nailed the crux of what the challenge is for her. And also, you mentioned somebody like Kevin Hart, who built his own production company around his comedy so that he could create the platform that he could maximize to get the most money for what he does. So, you know,
exactly. Perfect example.
You got both examples of what you talked about, you know, playing out. And, you know, not to get lost on, you know, that whole news story with Monique, but what you said about social media being your own stage, that's why I wish more people would understand, is that we're in an era right now, because of the internet, because of these great technology platforms like a Facebook, an IG, an Instagram, or, you know, like Twitter, you've got no excuse for not putting out content if you're a content creator, whether it's comedy, whether it's like me who I'm a podcaster, you know, so, you know, I'm putting out content that way. Whatever your thing is, right? Mm-hmm. You've got no excuse to complain about, oh, somebody ain't putting me on. Like, no, you put yourself on. You build your own audience, man. You know? And I remember hearing this guy, Tony Evans, who's a nationally renowned preacher from Texas.
Right.
He said something in his book that was very similar to what you said about your pool hall experience and your
Is that the book, No More Excuses?
No, this one is Kingdom Man. Well, maybe okay. It's Kingdom Man. But he said that in the book that he didn't try to preach to a ready-made congregation. You know, when God called him into his ministry, he preached to the people that he could preach to. And I said, man, that's so profound, because so often we want to be in front of, you know, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 people doing whatever we do, the big crowd.
Right.
And he started off by just being where he was at, doing what he does in front of those people who received it. So what you said, hey, I didn't have a comedy club to go to. So I started off at the Georgia Southern Pool Room making people laugh. Then I got a friend who came along and gave, like you said, gave you some support to, you know, create, you know, to create that opportunity for you to build a platform, and like you said, you capitalized on the support. You really took it and, you know, made the most out of it so that you could get to the point where you're at, and also redeem the investment that they made into you. I thought that was really, that to me, that was like a huge, I don't know, I should pay you for the wisdom that I just got. That was like huge nuggets, man, you know.
That's real. I mean, I would say on top of that, it was a lot of things that, when you're dealing with comedy or any type of entrepreneurship, where you have to depend on the gift that you've been given, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anytime when you open the gift you've been given, there is a certain trust factor, a trust level that you have to have with yourself and whoever you thought that gave you that gift.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just you and the gift giver at the end of the day. And yeah, sometimes you can open that gift in front of people, but sometimes you be so in the zone that you don't even see the people. Sometimes I've known I've lost myself so much on the stage, and I come off and I'm like, I don't even remember anybody laughing. And then people were like, dude, you killed it. And I was like, nobody laughed. They were like, no, they were just like, literally, when we saw you, you really were so much in a zone that you weren't even looking at us. You were looking at something totally different, but we were laughing our butts off. And I was like, well, that does it, because I really wasn't thinking about y'all. I think I was so interested in getting my gift out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then being appreciative of the person that gave me that gift, I didn't see nobody else.
Exactly.
And I think that's what artistic expression is missing, because I think sometimes we are concentrating on our audiences so much that we forget the gift. Like, I remember I became better at my craft when I stopped trying to make people laugh.
Wow. Yeah.
And I say that because sometimes when you become a slave to your audience, they lose respect for you.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's so true. I mean, that parallels into, you know, what I experience in the work I do in the church is that, you know, I could try and tell people what I think they want to hear, you know, and, you know, the scripture calls that, you know, kind of preaching to itching ears. You try to scratch their ears with the words you say, and instead of presenting the authentic truth, you know, and, you know, truth has a lot of different sources. You know, in the church, the truth is coming from a biblical perspective. But in your world, that authenticity of truth is coming out of you and the gift that you've got, and you don't try to change it or manipulate it to suit the audience. You just give them you.
Right.
You know, I'm glad I watched this interview with Deion Cole. He was on Sway today, that's when I watched the interview today, and he talked about giving people you. And not trying to give people what you think they want you to be. You know,
that's it. Because they came to see you.
That's it.
They didn't see to come to court justice. They came. They paid money to see your personality.
Yeah.
And to see if you believe in your personality enough to share it.
That's it. I'm looking at, you know, just that whole concept of you being true to yourself as you practice your gift. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, as a kind of, you know, transition to wrap us up, man, is, you know, that's what this whole podcast experience is trying to do is, you know, people were telling me on Facebook, once again, using social media as my stage, you know,
good.
That people were just like, hey, man, you know, you've got this sort of gravitas to you. You got this persona. Why don't you turn that into a podcast? I would love to hear that as a podcast. And I'm like, man,
right.
You know, I don't, you know, right. I'm sitting there thinking to myself, like, I don't know, man, people tell you to do stuff all the time because, you know, it don't cost them nothing for you to do it. You're the one that made the time investment, but I'm with you, man. It's definitely, especially with stuff like how Facebook has reactions now, you know, where you can react to a post. I would put something up, you know, I put something up, what did I put up that had people just dying laughing, apparently? I put up something to the effect of, like, hey, you know, all you single moms that I took out before tax season, y'all don't act like y'all don't know whose number this is when I text you, you know what I'm saying?
I remember that. That was hilarious.
Yeah.
That was funny, sir.
And
slow clap.
Yeah, slow. I'm just saying. And the thing is, it's being tested, to your point, through this stage and this platform. I'm getting reactions and feedback from people to know that, okay, that's you know, that killed. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't have to take that to the, you know, I don't have to go to a comedy club to know that killed. And so I took all of that feedback I get, and then that's kind of how I craft the content for the podcast. I think I just gave the secret sauce away, you know. I field tested on my Facebook feed, and then I say, okay, well, that was hot. People really responded to that. Let's take that piece and then let's use that for the podcast. And then that should have a similar impact and registry with people. So.
Right. I mean, I think just to piggyback a little, you know, just rewind it a little bit. I think one of the other things that helped me, because we were both in the Karl Marx department a lot, taking a lot of those different classes. I remember Professor Geierman from the Karl Marx department. He allowed me to do my final exam I was a public speaking class.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised with some of these classes that you take that will give you what you need in order to, you know, make it to whatever level you're trying to go to. I did a public speaking course, and he allowed me to do my final exam on the correct way to do a comedy routine.
Wow.
And for my final, he remembers me still. He was like, man, I remember your final. This is over 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
This was around 2005, 2006. And just that one course, and then making that attempt, because at first he wasn't going to let me do it. And I said, look, man, I know what I'm doing. I want to do that, you know, assignment to teach people how to specifically do the intro, the body, and, the punchline or conclusion and all this other stuff. And I did it right there in his class. And I wrote it out, man. And that's when I was just like, I can do this. Not only I can do this, but I can do public speaking.
And so,
because I had to do public speaking in order to explain comedy. And that's what I do. I do consulting now. I do public speaking in college campuses now.
Oh, wow.
And schools and mentoring programs now, man. And sometimes I moderate panels for people. And, I speak at MLK celebrations. I've done that a couple of times. I've been keynotes at different, award ceremonies and banquets and stuff like that. So it basically feeds itself, man. It's almost like a snowball effect worth the different talents and different opportunities. But like I said before, I think what is going to help a lot of people, if they need to understand where their help comes from and every angle their help comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us have to grow out of that. I have to grind. Ain't nobody going to help me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot of people who are not going to help you with certain things that's your responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, I became a better person when I started receiving help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you why. A lot of people with good hearts don't allow themselves to be good to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I've realized that. So a lot of people would help everybody but make themselves grind harder than they're supposed to.
Wow.
They would help everybody in the world, but when somebody wants to help them, they find different ways of not letting anybody to help them. Then they become bitter people, and then they can't share their gift while they're bitter because no one's helped them.
Exactly.
And the main thing they love to say is, man, ain't nobody really giving me no shot. I'm like, well, dude, or a young lady, it's plenty of people who try to help you, but you're like, no, I don't let nobody do for me like that, man. I want to grind them on. I got this pride.
Mm-hmm.
I said, have pride enough to accept help when you need it.
Oh, wow.
That's pride, too.
Yep.
You know, be proud of yourself to the point where you're not ashamed because you know you deserve help. Man, I ain't gonna lie to you, but I done helped out hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't expect them to help me, but I expect help.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's what I do, and I became a better person because of it.
I mean, you said something key there, man. I got to get you back on the podcast just to talk about your motivational stuff. And just your perspective, you know. Yeah, and, you know, but you said there, man, about, nobody's going to help you with something that's your responsibility, but essentially it's okay to receive help, you know, with the other stuff.
Yeah.
Like that just, you know, man, that really, I think I just grew there, you know, because, I've had opportunities in my life where I wanted to go the hardest route possible instead of taking the alley-oop, you know, like, hey, man, you still got to do the work when you get to this moment, but I can help you shortcut a lot of the nonsense if you'll come this path. You see what I'm saying? And, and just not thinking about it that way. Cause I'm thinking to myself like, man, I can't take the easy way. I got to do the hard way in reality, you know, to make a larger statement, you know, that's what our people as black folk, that's what we really need among each other is that spirit of helping each other. You know, like you said, nobody's going to do what you're responsible for doing. But at the same time, if I can give you a chance, you know, to get to that point where you can now take on the responsibility and execute, man, I mean, that's help, man. And like you said, I like how you said that I expect help. And you talked also,
heck yeah.
You know, you talked also about understanding every angle that your help comes from. Like you always hear that in church. Right. Like I know where my help comes from. You know, I'm making a mental note right now to plug that off into something for later on when I have a chance to talk about some things in church. You know, it's just understanding truly where your help comes from.
I'm gonna tell you how it's same. I'm gonna try to give you an example. You know how a body needs vitamin D, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. Picture us, because us as a people, and I say us, and I ain't necessarily talking about skin tone. I'm talking about just us.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? A lot of us have been told that we're supposed to have a harder life, and a harder life is supposed to be expected to the point where we believe it so much that we've created our own harder life.
Yep. Mm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where that self-fulfilling prophecy is so potent in the back of our minds that when we get it easy, we'll sabotage it, bro. I've seen it. I've done it. It's got to the point I'm like, now something's supposed to be much more horrible than this. Let's go ahead and crank up this stupidity or this laziness real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I'm saying? So it gets to that point where if you know good and well that, yes, you've worked hard, you've actually done what you're supposed to do, and somebody's trying to help you, what in the back of your mind tells you you're not supposed to get that help? Because secretly, deep down inside, we believe that our life's supposed to be harder.
Wow.
And guess what we just did? We just ensured that it was.
Yep, made it harder.
We just made it harder by not receiving the help that was given. And it was genuine help, too. And it's people that don't even expect nothing in return. But we'll find a way to make our lives harder, man. And I had to stop. Sometimes I catch myself doing it. But after a while, I'd be like, nah, I need help. Like, mm-hmm. right now, I ain't gonna lie to you. I need some help personally in my life now. I've been trying to just fight my way through it and just do my due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm finna call the person who offered me that help and be like, look, man.
Yeah.
Before I called you, I wanted for the sake of my word to you, I wanted to like exhaust every possibility before I called you.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? I exhausted every possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I was responsible for everything I'm responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
I gave the good try. I made the attempt, and all of my attempts failed.
Mm-hmm.
I even researched some more attempts, and those failed.
Mm-hmm.
You offered me help, and I can prove that I tried. What's up? Is that help still on the table?
Exactly. Exactly. Wow.
I've become a better person for it, man.
Wow.
No lie.
Wow. It's an amazing concept of, you know, shifting the mindset from I'm supposed to have it hard to, you know, why can't I get help when it's available to me to help me get over the hump and to make my life
mm-hmm.
easier like that. That's just wisdom, man. You know, that's just wisdom.
It's experience. It's self-sabotage, bro.
Because
you got to understand, us as a people, we've been given the same lyrics. You ever notice that sometimes you have a song that you can't stand,
mm-hmm.
but when the song comes on, you know the lyrics because you've heard it so much?
Yep.
We're suffering from that as a people. We got some of the most horrible lyrics about our life. We don't
Ooh.
Like them, but we sing them first.
Because you know them by heart.
Now, you know them by heart, because if somebody told you you had to work three times as hard of another person, or one out of three, you're going to be dead,
mm-hmm.
or another one three is not going to live past the age of 40, then you'll start emulating that type of statistic out in your everyday life.
Yep. Yep.
You'll start doing it. And then those statistics and those lyrics become your song. And then after a while, when you start singing that song, you'll start doing whatever the lyrics tell you to do.
Mm-hmm.
You'll start dying before the age of 40. You'll start, you know, sabotaging yourself. You'll start not having the relationships you want.
Exactly.
You'll start repeating those lyrics. You know what I mean? And, you know, I guess, like, one of the things, just to wrap it back to comedy kind of shed light on a lot of things that I thought I knew.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about the art of laughter that hopefully somebody can hear this, man, people need to research what does laughter do for your blood flow and your brain function.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people don't understand laughter, what laughter can do for your thought process.
Wow.
I became a much more critical thinker after I laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
No, when I'm nervous or upset, if I give a chuckle, not no fake laugh like you're enjoying yourself, I'm talking about just just like one of them, just lit it out to the point. For some strange reason, man, my brain starts saying, well, I noticed everything else, and I just scanned the whole room in 5 seconds. Do what
mm-hmm.
you need to do.
Wow.
I become a much better thinker when I laugh, man. And it's, you know, when people say choose happiness, they're not saying be unrealistic. If you're going through a hard time, you need to go through your sadness and your grief. But when they say, man, you need to choose your happiness, it's in your best interest. Not because you're trying to fake it and make everybody around you feel better or feel more comfortable. Choose happiness so you can function.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happiness is a function, bro. I need it.
Yeah.
You know, when my life be like in shambles, man, sometimes I'd be like, man, well, we get this comedy. I mean, this problem ain't gonna solve itself and it's probably too late to fix, but let me laugh, man, so I won't start ripping stuff off the walls or, you know what I'm saying? Go out there speeding at night or something. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
That's it, man. That's
you
it.
You need that. You definitely need that, man. So hopefully somebody got some help with that, but I'm proud of you, man. I'm actually proud of you for doing this, bro. You know, I've always been proud of you, but, you know, just for venturing out. Because you've always been a brilliant dude, and you've always been a business-minded individual, man. But you just exploring your options through your artwork and your ability to communicate, bro.
Wow.
This stuff ain't no – it's not no little thing, man. It takes a lot of courage to do that. You know, reaching out to people, recording the thoughts in our conversations to help people.
Mm-hmm.
If it was easy, everybody would do it.
You know what, man? I'm going to take that as encouragement and just positive feedback, because For me, it seems easy. I'm like, man, I know how to go and record stuff. I can get a microphone. I can sit down and call people. But you're right. If everybody could do it, everybody would be doing it. So,
anybody out there who's trying to do the comedy, man, stop trying to make people laugh and make people see you.
Wow.
Give them the opportunity to laugh. You don't have to make nobody do anything. If you want genuine laughs, stop trying to make people give it to you.
Wow. I think that's a great way to wrap up the podcast episode, and just great advice, man. Chris, what is your what's your social media that people can get in touch with you through, and how can people reach out to you if they got something that they want to use you for, to book you and all that stuff?
Man, I appreciate that. People can follow me on Facebook, first name Christopher, last name Pugh. That's spelled P-U-G-H, and it's pronounced like Hugh or Church. Pew or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not like, some of my teachers from back in the day, like Pug. Don't say Pug. We'll have to fight.
Pug.
But, yeah, man, I'm like, you a professor and you say Pugaha? What the hell? So, like, now, but also on social media, on Twitter, you can follow me on Twitter at Big Chris Joker, BigChrisJoker.
Okay.
And on Instagram, I'm under Manhood Mindset. Manhood Mindset is a radio show that I do right now where I mentor the youth over the radio.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, man. So what we actually try to do is get people into the show. We talk about things like mental health, relationships, religion, mm-hmm. politics. We talk about anything that affects our mindsets. And what we try to do is usually I have a guest or a co-host on the show, and we have conversations about topics. And we teach people how to listen and effectively communicate.
Wow.
And hopefully that will help everyone's mindset, because a lot of people are stressed out because a lot of us stop listening and stop talking.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us just, we react to what we want to hear and we say what we want to say, but we don't communicate.
Wow. Well, Chris, I'll tell you what, man. I'm sorry, finish your thought, man.
No. It's just Manhood Mindset. They can go to YouTube. It's M. Christopher Pugh. At gmail.com. That's my YouTube channel. And you can go to YouTube and just type in Manhood Mindset, and a lot of different episodes are popping up and stuff like that. So you can go ahead and research that. And other than that, I'm on Instagram, Manhood Mindset as well.
Okay.
So if you ever want me to come out to school to just talk to your students, I talk to a group of men, and I talk to women, and I talk to a mixed crowd. And I don't only talk to one race or one culture.
Mm-hmm.
I can communicate with anybody on the planet. You know what I'm saying?
Cool.
And I speak fluent. I speak fluent Decatur. So even if you are, you know what I mean? So I love my people. You know what I mean? So, but if anybody wants to book me, they can email me directly at mchristopherpugh@gmail.com. Again, that's mchristopherpugh@gmail.com. I do comedy shows, I host events, I do wedding receptions, man, and I'm not going to lie to you, I've even done a funeral reception, a comedy show for a funeral reception. I'm not going to lie to you. And that, you know what, I don't even lie about stuff like that, because I think funerals are serious.
I know
somebody asked me, because the person that passed away saw my show.
Oh, wow.
And was at an event, and they said, you know what, I don't want my reception, or I want my funeral to be sad. Have him host it and ask him to do some jokes.
Wow.
And I ain't gonna lie to you, it was one of the most, I can't explain it, but I'm glad I did it, but it was scary the entire time because I was trying to respect the family.
Yeah.
But the family wanted me to do it because they were supportive too. So I'm like, you can do anything with support, man.
That's it. Cool, man. Well, okay. Chris, man, I appreciate you. Definitely taking the time, man, to do this interview and to do this conversation with me. And I got a lot of just great wisdom from you. And we're definitely going to reach back out and we're going to do some more content, I'm sure, man.
Bro, anytime you want to interview me, man, I'm available straight up.
Cool.
I will make myself available because I really appreciate what you're doing. This is going to help a lot of people.
Cool.
Definitely.
Well, Chris, you be good, man.
Hey, man. Take care, man. I'll meet you at the next buffet, brother.
What an interview with Christopher Pugh. So glad he could come by and chat on the Culture and Conversations podcast. And with that, we have come to an end of yet another episode. We want to thank Piano Flavor for this beat, Hip Hop Instrumental Number 20, a free download on SoundCloud. That is Piano Flavor. Love this beat. Just real chill, got a nice little bass line in it. Piano is a nice touch. Anyway, if you want to check out the Culture and Conversations podcast, please follow along on Facebook at Culture and Conversations. That's the name of the page, Culture and Conversations. If you want to follow along on IG and interact with the guests on the show, please check them out on my Facebook page and on my Instagram page. Culture and Conversations is the handle. And finally, if you just want to send out some email and reach out to the show and say hello, if you don't want to do it on social media, then email cultureandconversations@gmail.com. We got some great things going on. We're beginning to develop some video content, snippets, so that people can listen to parts of the podcast and see what the whole thing is about. Also, we're getting ready to launch the YouTube page. You can already guess what the title of the YouTube page is, Culture and Conversations. We got some video content that's going to be coming. People want to, I guess, see my face, and I want to share it with them. Not to get too technical, but we do plan on using ads to support the Culture and Conversations podcast. So as we grow the following, we hope that you guys will endure a few advertisements so that we can continue to bring you this great content. Simple goals, entrepreneurship, empowering the platform that we are on. Oh, I like how that beat just broke down there. I wasn't expecting that. Anyway, you guys be great. And once again, thank you for being a part of the conversation here on the Culture and Conversations podcast.